Welcome to another episode of the Gunblog Variety Cast with your hosts, Sean Sorrentino and Aaron Paulette.
Welcome to episode 126 of the Gunblog Variety Cast, a proud member of the Self-Defense Radio Network. How are you doing, Aaron?
Okay. I don't want to be a bummer, but I got some bad news the other day. I went to the dentist for my cleaning, and I've been having a sore spot on one of my gums. And they looked at it, and they became very interested in it in the way that is uncomfortable when doctors or dentists suddenly become interested in a part of your body. And so they took an x-ray of it, and turns out that I have an abscess in my jaw. And so part of that bone is infected because the tooth is infected. And so they're telling me that they're going to have to go in and do a root canal on the tooth to clear out the infected nerve, and then that should help with... I don't understand exactly how it works, but the dentist tells me that when you remove the source of infection, the bad bone will be replaced with good bone. And it needs to be done pretty much immediately. And the bad news is that the endodontist estimates that it being around $800, and they don't take installments. So... it looks like me going to Mag 40 next month is on hold. Because, you know, I got to pay for this because I don't want my jaw to fall off. I'm trying to find a way to swing both. I like to think of myself as being scrappy and resourceful, and I'm scrambling to find some way to pay for this that doesn't prevent me from going to Mag 40. But, I'm not in the best of mood because of that.
Yeah, and we got to figure out how to get you not only to Mag 40, but we still got to get you to NRA in, what's that, the end of April.
Yeah. All right, so on that bright and cheery note, how are you doing, Sean?
I'm not doing too bad. I got my first one-hour training session with Chris Tilley at the Personal Defense and Handgun Safety Center in Raleigh. It was interesting because some of the stuff that he taught me was very different than what I saw in a more defensive-minded class, like the grip. The grip that he taught me was a sort of a push and pull grip rather than the typical defensive, just grip it as hard as you can grip. So that was interesting. It was more stable than what I'd been using. So there's that.
Right. Like you push with your strong hand and you pull back with your weak hand, right?
Sort of, yeah. But it's not the radical bend your elbow weaver thing. It's still an isosceles stance.
Right.
But it's a push and pull and grip on the narrow front end and the narrow back end and not squeezing it like, as Bob Vogel says, a monkey squeezing a baseball bat.
Huh.
He was trying to teach me the different ways you use your sights and the trigger. Because you know you're not supposed to slap the trigger, right?
Right.
Wrong.
What?
You just slap the hell out of it. Because if the target is 5 yards or closer and wide open, you really going to have a hard time pulling the gun off the target if you're holding it correctly. So any time that you take to manage the trigger in that situation is time you've wasted. Combat and action pistol are basically the same in that you want acceptable accuracy as fast as possible. Anytime you spend managing the trigger to get more accuracy than you need is time you've wasted. So that was interesting. I kind of knew that, but you know, it's a little hard to stop being, you know, really, really careful about how you pull the trigger because that's what we were taught, right?
Yeah, aim small, miss small.
Right. But you know what? You've got an 8-inch circle on an IDPA target for a down zero. As long as you're touching the line or in, it's still down zero. So don't waste the time. And you can move on to other targets, which are more difficult, and take the time there. The one thing that I was really happy with is that reloads have always been kind of a... it either works or it's a complete and total disaster. You know, occasionally I'll get hung up and I'll fight with it and I'll get it in, but there's times where the magazine just goes sailing across the room. And so I did a lot of dry fire practice and that included a lot of reload practice. Well, the couple of times I had to reload in front of him, he said, well, we really don't need to work on that. The one thing I would say is you need to get your thumb off the mag release button faster. So I was like, that's really cool. I was like actually doing reloads and not looking like a total idiot. Big plus. Now, Chris was wearing this awesome shirt. How many times have you heard slow is smooth and smooth is fast, right?
Many, many times.
Oh, and you know how much that drives me up the wall.
Yes, I do.
I swear I did not set this up. He walks into the bay as we're about to start, and I look, and he's wearing this bright yellow shirt, and it's got this sloth hanging from a tree, and I'm like, oh, what's that? And I read it. It says, slow is smooth, and also slow. I decided I wanted one of these shirts. Well, they're sold by Atlanta Arms. There's a link in the show notes if you really want one, but it's $25 for the shirt, and they want like $18 in shipping costs to get it to me. I'm like, are you insane? And then I thought, well, what if I bought like five or so of them? It's $18 per each. Like, no, something's not right. So I think I may have to call them and say, hey, what are you guys doing? Like, because all you have to do is stick it in a priority envelope. You can ship it to me like $6. Or it's in Atlanta. It's actually in Covington, about an hour from the NRA convention. Maybe we can just like have them come to the NRA convention with a couple of these shirts. I know a certain competition shooter who wants one. She doesn't know she wants one, but she wants one.
All right. So for those who are playing Gunblog VarietyCast Bingo, we had acceptable combat accuracy, slapping the trigger, isosceles stance, aim small, miss small, and slow is smooth. Let us know if you got bingo. Thanks to Lucky Gunner and Remington for their support of the Gunblog VarietyCast. From Golden Saber to Range Rounds, get a full lineup of quality Remington ammo that ships fast at LuckyGunner.com.
All right, let's get on with the show.
As Beth prepares for this year's SHOT Show, she gives us a woman's perspective on it. The first show she attended was back in 2000, and some things have changed, but some have not.
It's that time of year again when so many people in the shooting, hunting, outdoor industry are getting ready for the biggest trade show of the year. That's right. SHOT Show 2017 is right around the corner, and pretty much everybody I know is either talking about it or getting ready for it or already there. The thing about SHOT Show is very intriguing to me is that I actually started going roughly 17 years ago, and one of the very first times I was there with a colleague of mine, and she and I were actually on the show floor a day early checking things out and making some preparations when a man nearby made a comment to his buddy, "Oh look, booth babes." I'm actually changing the derogatory term he used since I was and still am repulsed and offended by it, but you get the idea. I immediately shot the guy a harsh look, and my friend and I were just really confused. We were dressed professionally, we were behaving quite professionally, and we were there for extremely professional reasons. It was unnerving to think that these men immediately assumed that two blonde women at this particular event must be no more than showy eye candy for the vendors to parade around hoping to lure in curious gawkers. Of course, there are still booth babes to this day, but I have seen a change, and that's what's really exciting. Instead of women kind of being behind the scenes in the industry, maybe working PR or marketing, and instead of women just being showy eye candy at the booth, nowadays, you see so many more women who are shooters, who are entrepreneurs, who are basically starting their own businesses and are the face of their own businesses. So for women, things have changed in a positive light in many ways. And obviously, some of those things we're not going to get rid of. Sex sells, and we're in Las Vegas. So yeah, you're going to see some of those women who absolutely have no clue what's going on with the shooting, hunting, outdoor world, but they were paid to come out and dress scantily and attract people to come in and see what those new products and services might be. At any rate, most people are really excited for this show just because we get to see what's new, what's exciting, what's innovative. And of course, it's a big giant networking pool of pretty much everybody you can think about, whether it's the celebrity shooter or the celebrity YouTube personality to, you know, all the workers, all the people behind the ideas, all the people who are actually creating these new products and services. So it's an intriguing mix of ideas, really. And I'm really looking forward to it. This is actually going to be the first year that I'm attending and I'm not a free agent. Usually I have attended the SHOT Show as a freelance writer and editor. So this time I'm definitely going to the show with some fresh eyes, with some new purpose and some very, very different, I guess, agendas. Of course, for me, I'm not really in the hunting and outdoor industry anymore, although that is where I kind of got my start. but I'm super excited about seeing some of the new guns, seeing some of the new innovations as far as training opportunities for firearms. I know that there are a lot of companies that are constantly revising, reworking, and rethinking various components that can make people shoot faster and better, hopefully, in the long run. I am attending the show this year as a USCCA team member, so if you have time and if you can find us, we would love for you to pop by the booth at L208. It would be a fun time just to say hello, whether you're a fan of the podcast or you're a fan of USCCA or you're just a fan of SHOT Show, shooting, hunting, and other wonderful outdoor activities. So make plans to do that if you are going to be there. Would love to say hello and would love to hear your thoughts about what you've seen at the SHOT Show this year, what new products or services you're excited about. And of course, I'd love to hear your thoughts about the booth babes. How's the count looking? Are the numbers up this year, or are we looking like we're actually paying attention to the women in the industry and allowing them to use their voices for things that are truly meaningful and important? Well, and speaking of SHOT Show, I have got some packing to do, so I'm going to cut this short, go fill my suitcase, and hopefully be able to fill my brain with all the wonderful things we're learning and seeing out there. Until next time, stay safe and be well armed.
You can read more from Beth at usconcealedcarry.com/blog and click on Pacifiers and Peacemakers in the left sidebar.
This podcast runs on your donations. Go to gunblogvarietycast.com and click on the donate or the subscribe button in the right sidebar. You can make a one-time donation of any amount or subscribe for as little as $2 a month. That doesn't sound like much, but we pay our server costs monthly, and a little help from you is a big help to us.
Felons behaving badly. Fatal home invasion. He grabbed me and pushed me into the apartment. Dateline Wilmington, North Carolina. A man accused of attacking a woman returning to her home around 10:40 Monday night died after he was shot during the home invasion. "I'm just glad I'm alive," Kay Dickinson said a day after the incident happened. She was coming home from work when she noticed a man with a bag of garbage at the end of the hallway for her apartment. Dickinson said she went to unlock her door and the man attacked. "He grabbed me and pushed me into the apartment," Dickinson said. "We had a tussle, and he choked me and gagged me, and I dropped everything right there in the kitchen." Dickinson said the man, later identified as 35-year-old suspect, knew her name and her boyfriend's. He kept saying, "Give me the money, give me the money," Dickinson said, explaining she didn't keep any in the house. Now here's a little audio clip from an interview that they did with her.
"He took me in the bedroom and put, I had a broken belt on the floor, and he grabbed it, tied my hands behind my back, got a cell phone charger cord and wrapped it around my mouth and tied it. And then he proceeded to look under the bed, and I got loose from the belt and I had a gun sitting on a Bible on my headboard. I jumped up on the bed, grabbed the gun, turned around, and just pulled the trigger. And once I pulled the trigger, he ran towards the door. And he opened the door, and then he fell down right in the doorway."
She called 911 and took the gun out of his hand. "I don't know if he was alive or dead," she said. Police found suspect near the front door when they arrived at the apartment. Dickinson was taken to the hospital to be treated for minor injuries. She has since been released. No charges have been filed at this time.
Well, they'd better not be either. I'm very sorry for what she went through, but I am so glad she shot this guy. I have no idea what he might have done to her if he had, well, heck, even if he had found money. You know, anyone who's willing to assault you and rob your apartment, you know, "Oh, there's a tied up woman here. Well, I might as well have some fun." Ugh.
He tied her up in the bedroom, on her bed. What do you think he was up to?
Yeah. So I'm sorry that she went through it. She's probably traumatized that she killed a person. And that's all right, I understand that, but just in that overall scheme of things, I'm glad he's dead.
You're not going to hear me complaining about him dying.
So what kind of choir boy was he, Sean?
Larceny, misdemeanor, class 1. 2 counts, misdemeanor breaking and entering, misdemeanor, class 1. Assault on a public official, misdemeanor, class 1. Possessing stolen goods, misdemeanor, class 1. Receiving stolen goods, misdemeanor, class 1. Wanton injury to personal property, $200 and less, misdemeanor class 1. Assault on an officer, state employee, misdemeanor class A1. Breaking and entering vehicles, felon class I. Forgery, felon class I. Possession with intent to sell, schedule 6, felon class I. Uttering forged papers, instruments, felon class I. 2 counts possessing stolen goods, felon class H. Receiving stolen goods, felon class H. And burglary in the second degree, felon class G.
Ah, so he was escalating. Lovely.
Nobody's gonna miss him.
She obviously didn't.
Baron is on assignment and will return soon. The main topic segment, concealed carry reciprocity. It's finally being introduced. It's probably going to be H.R. 38, but it's being introduced by a North Carolina representative, Representative Hudson. We happen to have a copy of the bill as it is going to be introduced. Representative Hudson has it on his website. There's a link in the show notes, and I encourage everybody to read it. But we're going to do something we haven't done in a long time and read a bill. I used to do this on the blog all the time, and it was really helpful in understanding what a bill actually said so that we could argue from the perspective of, well, this is what it really says, as opposed to wild made-up stuff that you always get in these discussions. Right, Aaron?
Absolutely. No PSH here.
So the current issue that everybody's talking about is that national reciprocity will apply to non-resident gun permits as well as resident gun permits. But I think they're missing a couple of real gems in this one. Why is it important, Aaron, that non-resident gun carry permits will still be able to use this reciprocity?
Well, it's so that people who live in repressive states where they can't get a concealed carry permit, like New York, New Jersey, Maryland, things like that, can get an out-of-state permit, and then they can carry within their own state because that out-of-state permit will be recognized nationally.
So it's a race to the bottom. So you can live in New Jersey, which issues concealed handgun permits to people who are politically connected or apparently must have like serious blackmail power. And you can live in that state and you can get a Florida concealed weapons permit or whatever it's called down there and carry in New Jersey?
Well, yeah, that's true. Although, why go to the trouble of getting a Florida permit? Just get a Pennsylvania permit. It's what, $35 and you're out?
Yeah, pretty much. I have a Pennsylvania license to carry firearms because I visit my parents up there, and I've always thought if I ever have to talk to a police officer while I'm carrying a gun, he's going to be a whole lot more receptive to the Pennsylvania license to carry firearms than he is to my North Carolina, which doesn't even have a picture on it. So I renewed my Pennsylvania license to carry, and I did that face-to-face. I went up to the Erie County Sheriff's Office. They took my picture. I filled out a form, and they printed me one up and laminated it and handed it to me. I went out the door, and I think it really was like $35. So if you're in New Jersey, you just go across the border into one of the border counties and get yourself a license to carry firearms, and you can carry anywhere in the nation. Let's go through this bill line by line here. In little, maybe not line by line, but let's go through some sections. The first section, which I think is very interesting, is it explains who can carry under this law. Notwithstanding any provision of the law of any state or political subdivision thereof, except as provided by subsection B and some other stuff, a person who is not prohibited by federal law from possessing, transporting, shipping, or receiving a firearm, who is carrying a valid identification document containing the photograph of the person, and who is carrying a valid license or permit which is issued pursuant to the law of a state and which permits the person to carry a concealed firearm, or is entitled to carry a concealed firearm in the state in which the person resides, may possess or carry a concealed handgun, other than a machine gun or destructive device, that has been shipped or transported in interstate or foreign commerce in any state. And then there's some more stuff.
And the key point there is the word or, not and.
See, they're talking about, well, you know, you can get a concealed handgun permit from another state than the state you live in and then carry all over the nation. Oh, no. Well, here's what's really funny. It also includes or is entitled to carry a concealed firearm in the state in which the person resides.
You know, that sounds a lot like constitutional carry.
Wait, so if I live in Vermont and I'm entitled by law, I mean, there's no law against it, I can carry a concealed firearm in Vermont. That means just because I have a Vermont driver's license means I can carry all over the nation.
Well, you know, I'm not a lawyer, but that's what it sounds like to me. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's pretty funny. So basically, as long as the state, there's a next section which I skipped over, but basically it says as long as the state has a statute that says you can carry concealed in that state, and doesn't prohibit the carrying of the residents of that state, which is there's no state in the union that prohibits concealed carry.
Not for lack of trying.
So basically, as long as the state allows it for one person who is just a citizen, not a police officer or a military, then they have to let you carry in their state if you have a license or permit, or if you live in a constitutional carry state. That's pretty amazing. So there's your big bombshell right there. If you live in a constitutional carry state, you can carry anywhere without even a license to carry.
But wait, there's more.
So how do you prove that it's okay for you to carry? A person who carries or possesses a concealed handgun in accordance with subsections A and B may not be arrested or otherwise detained for a violation of any law or any rule or regulation of a state or any political subdivision thereof related to the possession, transportation, or carrying of firearms unless there is probable cause to believe that the person is doing so in a manner not provided for in this section. Presentation of facially valid documents as specified in subsection A is prima facie evidence that the individual has a license or permit as required by this section. So facially valid, what that means is you hold a concealed handgun permit and it's not outside the dates and it has your picture on it or has your name or it's a valid permit like mine is. Even if it happens to have been revoked, it's facially valid. It looks like it's valid. They can't arrest or otherwise detain you for violation of those laws. So let's say they do detain you, they do arrest you, they do charge you under one of these state laws. The next section says, when a person asserts this section as a defense in a criminal proceeding, the prosecution shall bear the burden of proving, beyond a reasonable doubt, that the conduct of the person did not satisfy the conditions set forth in subsections A and B. So they can't just say, well, you know, it's up to you to prove that you were following the law. They have to prove you weren't, which seems like should be normal, but you know what states do. When a person successfully asserts this section as a defense in a criminal proceeding, the court shall award the prevailing defendant a reasonable attorney's fee. So, you know what they say, you can beat the rap, but you can't beat the ride. So they're just going to arrest you. You're going to get a trial. You're going to pay a lot of money, and eventually you'll get it back, but you've lost all that time and energy. You've lost that money. You know what's going to happen, right? You know how these people act. They're just going to say, you know, let's just mess with people.
Well, the TLDR version is you can sue them for that.
A person who is deprived of any right, privilege, or immunity secured by this section under the color of any statute, ordinance, regulation, custom, or usage of any state or any political subdivision thereof may bring an action in any appropriate court against any other person, including a state or political subdivision thereof, who causes the person to be subject to the deprivation for damages and other appropriate relief. The court shall award a plaintiff prevailing in an action brought under paragraph 1 damages and such other relief as the court deems appropriate, including a reasonable attorney's fee.
And the best part about that is you aren't just suing the city or the state. You can sue individual persons like the cop who arrests you or the overzealous district attorney who decides to prosecute you because it's an election year.
Or the cop supervisors and the town board and anybody else who says, no, you must do this.
Mm-hmm. This has teeth.
Don't you have something similar in Florida?
Yes, we do. We have preemption with teeth. And it comes down to roughly the state makes the rules. And there have been other counties or town subdivisions who have tried to say, well, it's different with us. And not only is that not allowed, but when that is struck down, the people responsible are sued for it. And we call it preemption with teeth.
All right, so what? You know, you can carry a gun, but why don't we just make magazines illegal? Or like California, where there's, you know, 10-round magazines are illegal, but 11 will get you a felony.
Yeah. Well, it turns out that for the purposes of this bill, they specifically define handgun to also mean any magazine, well, any pistol magazine, and any ammunition.
The term handgun includes any magazine for use in a handgun and any ammunition loaded into the handgun or its magazine. So if you have hollow points as you're traveling through New Jersey.
Too bad. They can't do a thing about it.
Yeah.
oh, you have a standard capacity 17-round Glock magazine. Sorry, New York Safe Act. Suck it.
I wonder if that applies if you're a resident of the state. Let's say you live in New York and you're carrying on a Florida or a Pennsylvania permit, I guess. Can you just say, well, I'm carrying this, and it's according to federal law, it's part of the handgun, so too bad? That would be a fun test case.
I'm not a lawyer. I don't want to be that test case, but that's how it looks to me.
Now here's an interesting segment. A person who possesses or carries a concealed handgun under subsection A shall not be subject to the prohibitions of section 922Q with respect to that handgun. What the heck is that?
I had to look this up because just about every gun owner knows about the stupidity that is 922R, but 922Q had to look up. And that deals with the 1,000-foot gun-free zone that emanates not on school property, but marking from the perimeter of school property.
So the Federal Gun-Free School Zones Act. So that means if I'm carrying on any permit anywhere, the Federal Gun-Free School Zones Act doesn't apply to me. It seems like every little thing that they've come up with, you know, oh, well, what happens if this, okay, we'll write that into the law. Oh, what happens if they try to ban mag? Oh, we're going to write that in the law. Oh, the federal gun-free schools, oh, we'll write that in the law too. So I'm like, they're taking away every opportunity that I can think of for them to arrest you.
Yeah.
Now, one of the issues we have here in Raleigh is that one of our parks is land that is actually run by the Bureau of Land Management, I think. Or the Army Corps of Engineers, one of the two. So you can't carry in this park, even though you can carry in every other state park. That state park is on Army Corps of Engineer property because it's some kind of a flood project that the Army Corps of Engineers did. Well, there's a little section that says, a person possessing or carrying a concealed handgun in a state under subsection A may do so in any of the following areas in the state that are open to the public: a unit of the National Park System, a unit of the National Wildlife Refuge System, public land under the jurisdiction of the Bureau of Land Management, land administered and managed by the Army Corps of Engineers, land administered and managed by the Bureau of Reclamation. Now, for those Eastern people like me now, and you too, Aaron, who don't know, the Bureau of Reclamation runs a bunch of water and hydroelectric stuff out west. I had to look that up.
Yeah, I didn't know what it was at all.
The amendments made by this section shall take effect 90 days after the date of the enactment of this act. So as soon as President Trump signs, it's the law of the land 90 days later. So we've already discussed that it is non-resident permits, as well as people who live in constitutional carry states. And one of the big issues we always hear from people is, in fact, you even asked this one, Aaron, when I was talking about it. I say, well, we should talk about this.
Yeah, anytime the subject comes up, someone always brings up the question of, what about the different standards that different states have for permits? Because some states are just completely arduous to get, and then others, like Pennsylvania, are quite easy. And how do you reconcile those two?
I've looked through this. The standards must be this high. It's baloney. There's no rules. There's nothing like that. It just says if you have a concealed handgun permit in your state and it's issued to somebody, it's valid all over the country.
Yeah, I'm looking at this bill and I'm delighted, but there's a part of me that's going, this is too good to be true. There's no way this can pass.
Well, see, that's because we keep acting like we're a minority in this country and like the world will never give us what we want. Baloney. It absolutely will. We just got to work for it.
I mean, I would say the odds are very good. What with the Republicans controlling the House and the Senate and the executive branch, I don't know what the proper word for it is. I desperately want this to happen. I'm just braced for that other shoe to fall because we can't have nice things. But please, universe, prove me wrong.
Exactly.
After a brief hiatus for some intensive training in Oklahoma, Tiffany returns as a full-blown, card-carrying member of the Black Panther Party. Just kidding. But she did encounter the Panthers in a Law Review article, and that reminded her of some of the more sinister motives behind the origins of gun control.
You never really understand a person until you consider things from his point of view. Till you climb inside of his skin, walk around in it.
Hey guys, it's Tiffany. I am back, and I really missed you, so it's good to be back. I was busy last week having a blast with a bunch of really cool people, including Sean's brother, who was at a training class with me, three-day class over the weekend, which is why my voice is kind of gone a little bit because I was role-playing. And of course, I had the honor of playing the hysterical screaming chick for a couple of the scenarios. So I have very little voice left. So I apologize for that bit of hoarseness. Another thing that I have done over the past couple of weeks and have been meaning to talk to you guys about is I found an article that I wanted to share with our listeners. It is called California's Attempts to Disarm the Black Panthers. This is a Law Review article. It was published in 1999 in the San Diego Law Review. It's written by Cynthia Dytle, and I am almost certainly butchering the pronunciation of her name. I'll pop a link in the show notes, but it's Deitle, Cynthia Dytle, who, if I have tagged the right person on the interwebs, she is an FBI agent and also a lawyer and a Second Amendment advocate who penned this Law Review article about the Panthers. Now, before you worry, this is not a commercial for the Black Panthers, okay? There's a whole lot of stuff about the Panthers that I take issue with. And I think, you know, it's funny, even to this very day in the Black community, there's a kind of a push and pull between the early Malcolm X Black Panthers factions that are all about don't tread on me, basically, versus the Martin Luther King faction, which is all about nonviolence at any cost. This is way before Cooper started saying revolutionary things like violence is good. So, but that tension persists to this day. I think it's a really interesting dichotomy, two different ways to approach problems. But I'm getting off topic already. Let's go back to this article by Cynthia Dytle. Again, it's called California's Attempts to Disarm the Black Panthers. And for a bit of context, we'll talk about how things were in the 60s. Some of our listeners might remember this. Others are too young to know. But in the article, there are a few summaries or a few little anecdotes just to set the stage. Here's one, and I quote, "In Monroe, North Carolina, in 1957, Robert Williams, the president of the local NAACP, taught others that blacks should defend themselves with guns. When some local Klan members attacked the house of another leader of the local NAACP, Williams and a group of blacks armed themselves with rifles and returned fire, causing the Klan to flee." John Lewis, who is now, of course, a member of Congress, but who in the 60s was president of SNCC, or the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, is supposed to have written a telegram or sent a telegram to Robert Kennedy in September of 63, according to this article, in which John Lewis said to Kennedy, quote, "Just what do you expect Negroes to do to defend themselves against vicious onslaughts from whites with clubs and sticks or dynamite and guns?" End quote. That's what he asked. What do you expect us to do to defend ourselves? Well, to the Panthers, the answer was we should be armed, right? That's pretty much how they approach things. The article goes on to say, during this era, African Americans feared not only white supremacist groups and mobs, but also the police. So again, this is in the 60s, but let's see. Here's one example. The conduct of Police Commissioner T. Eugene Bull Connor during a May 14, 1961 attack on Freedom Riders in Birmingham, Alabama, provides a prime example. While the Klansmen with lead pipes beat black victims, Connor, the police commissioner, purposefully delayed police response to the scene for at least 15 minutes because prior to the attack, Connor and the Klan members had reached an agreement that Connor would arrive only after the attack had escalated. So they had secretly made a pact that the police would delay coming to break up these beatings by the Klan until they had had sufficient time to beat the African Americans to their satisfaction, I guess. It's really sickening. Some of you may have heard of Don P. Cates Jr., who's a lawyer, a civil rights activist, does some legal work for the NRA. I believe he just recently died a year or two ago, maybe not even that long. But this article by Ms. Dytle quotes Don Cates. Let's see. The article says, Cates recalled one situation in which Klansmen broke up a series of marches in Louisiana with hideous violence and head bashing while the police looked on in benevolent neutrality. Cynthia Dytle writes that it was during this period in history that, quote, while many blacks, white civil rights workers, and other innocent people in the racial struggle were threatened, assaulted, and murdered by whites with firearms, the victims were discovering the benefits of self-armament. Okay, so this is the backdrop under which the Black Panthers rose. And it was only then that, you know, the Panthers started marching in the streets, especially in California and in Oakland, San Francisco, and Los Angeles. They would walk the streets with rifles and pistols. And it was only then that the California legislature proposed an emergency bill to ban the open carry of loaded firearms. Now, in the article, Ms. Dytle argues that it was the state's brash revulsion to the idea of black folks with guns that led them to propose this legislation. Some of the proponents of this act argued that, oh, it was just meant to disarm the KKK or to disarm neo-Nazis or the Minutemen. But of course, the KKK had been around since right after the Civil War, and no legislation had ever been penned to knock down the KKK before now. It was only when the Panthers got guns that everybody said, oh, crap, we can't have this. We need gun control. White people had walked around with guns all the time, but only when the Panthers started doing it did the legislature suddenly leap into action on guns. The bill was written by a Republican assemblyman named Don Mulford. And of course, you know by now I'm talking about the Mulford Act of 1967. Not only did this Republican assemblyman pen the act, but then Governor Ronald Reagan, Republican Governor Ronald Reagan, also supported it. And in response to seeing these Panthers standing outside the Capitol with their guns, Ronald Reagan reportedly said, there's no reason why on the street today a citizen should be carrying loaded weapons. Reagan called it a ridiculous way to solve problems that have to be solved among people of goodwill. Of course, the implication there is that people with firearms could not be people with goodwill, which obviously is incorrect. At any rate, Assemblyman Mulford's act passed overwhelmingly, and believe it or not, a version of that gun control law still exists on the books today. The current version reads as follows. A person is guilty of carrying a loaded firearm when the person carries a loaded firearm on the person or in a vehicle while in a public place or on a public street in an incorporated city or in any public place or any public street in a prohibited area of an unincorporated territory. In other words, if you're carrying a loaded firearm, if you don't fall into one of these statutory exceptions, then you are at least a misdemeanant and in some instances a felon. Now, California is famous for being liberal and pro-diversity and anti-gun. But many present-day liberals and minority groups don't realize how California first made its mark on the gun control stage. They don't realize that California's original aversion to guns did not quite align with all the progressive ideals that Californians celebrate today. Liberals and minorities oftentimes don't realize that gun control was supported by a Republican conservative governor who would later become one of the most revered U.S. presidents of the conservative base, Ronald Reagan. So, bottom line is, gun control is not about political affiliation. It's not about the left or the right. It's not about safety, although that's usually a more palatable and more politically expedient way to frame the issue. In many respects, in my opinion, gun control isn't even really about guns. I bet if you ask the Black Panthers, They would say that gun control was more about people control. In her article, Cynthia Dietl concludes by asking, how far will citizens allow their representatives to go when they act to disarm one group under the guise of protecting the safety of other groups? I invite our listeners to think about that for a minute, especially those listeners who are on the fence about gun control. I hope that all groups will keep this in mind when assessing legislation aimed at hogtying people of other political groups or other races or other demographics or any other others that you want to keep under control or away from your comfort zone. Just remember that that's a revolving door and it'll come back to bite you sooner or later. We can't strip away everybody's freedom out of fear of what certain others might do with those freedoms. Instead, I think it's probably better to work on being a model of how real freedom is responsibly wielded and to inspire others to do the same. But I'm starting to get a little soapboxy now, so I will cut it and just ask everybody to please stay safe and keep it centered and even. I'll talk to you next week.
You can follow Tiffany at frontsightpress.com.
And now it's time for Blue Collar Prepping with that bratty kid sister of the gun blogosphere, Erin Paulette.
Come on, every pony! It's time for Blue Collar Prepping with Erin Paulette!
So last week, Sean and I talked about the preparations he'd made for the snowpocalypse that was slated to hit North Carolina. And later on Facebook, he posted a picture of his bathtub full of water jugs. And he captioned it, "This is about 40 gallons, or 3 flushes of the toilet." And then in the comments, he explained, "During the power outage from the hurricane, I had to pour water into the toilet to make it flush the poo," the wife insisted. "Each flush was 2.5 gallons. It was like sacrificing a baby watching all that water I'd driven to Walmart to get going down the toilet." And I agree, using 2.5 gallons of fresh drinking water to flush the toilet is wasteful. So let's talk about making the most out of our drinking water by utilizing the blue-gray-black water cycle. Blue water, also sometimes called white water, but that makes me think of rapids, is water fit for human consumption. The technical term is potable, and it's what you drink and cook with and bathe in, and usually what you wash your clothes in. Gray water is what used to be blue water but goes down the drain. It's not drinkable because it's soiled with things like dirt, soap, bits of food, hair, shampoo, skin cells, and so forth. But it's not harmful to a human being. You could bathe in gray water without ill effects. Black water is what leaves your toilet, and it is decidedly not safe to be exposed to because it's full of pathogens that are just waiting to infect you if they get past your skin. So the general thought behind this cycle is that you can use water more than once, going from levels of highest potability to lowest, if you are in a situation like Sean where your water resources are limited. Here's an example of how that would work in a limited water emergency. When preparing food or washing yourself or your clothes, don't pour that water down the sink. Instead, catch it in a container of some kind. The blue water has now become gray. And if you really want to ration water, you can wash your clothes and your dirty dishes in the gray water. I would caution you that the grease and other food elements might not be the best for your clothes, but it is possible. Washing dishes and utensils in gray water isn't as bad, since metals and ceramic aren't going to absorb the odors and the stains, but make sure that 1, you use lots of soap, and 2, you rinse them off with blue water before putting them away for use. Now, depending on the soap and other elements in the gray water, you might be able to use it for watering plants. In fact, gray water irrigation is a rabbit hole that is outside the scope of this article, so I'm going to suggest that anyone who is interested should check out the article titled "How Gray Water Reclamation Works" in the show notes. For our example here, though, we're just going to assume that you aren't going to do that, and instead you save that gray water for flushing the toilet. Now, it must be said, when it comes to conserving water, the "if it's yellow, let it mellow" rule is in effect. Otherwise, you're going to be flushing a lot more often, which is exactly what we want to avoid. When it comes time to flush it down because it's brown, you take your bucket or tub or whatever container of gray water you have and you pour about a gallon of it quickly from about 2 feet. You don't want it so high that you get splashed, but you want it high enough that the force of the water gets a gravity assist. Now, past a certain point, the pressure of water in the bowl will be greater than the air pressure in the pipes beyond, and that force will induce a flush. There's a YouTube video in the show notes if you need a demonstration. So after you pour the gray water into the toilet, it becomes black water. And because you've caused it to flush, that black water is no longer your concern. Now, before you decide to start saving your gray water for flushing, you need to know that gray water becomes black water within about 24 hours due to the bacteria in the water eating the food particles and giving off its own waste. So don't let it become a health hazard. Flush it away. But with that in mind, Sean and everyone else can be a lot happier if the water goes out during a winter storm, because 1 gallon of gray water is a lot less heart-wrenching to flush than 2.5 gallons of blue water. And if you'd like to read more about getting by on limited water, check out the linked article of the same name on Blue Collar Prepping, linked in the show notes.
Not only can you subscribe or donate to the podcast, you can also make a contribution to the LGBT Training Ammo Fund. Go to gunblogvarietycast.com and click on the LGBT Training Ammo Fund donation button in the right sidebar. I'll use this money to pay for range fees, targets, and yes, ammo for the people I teach. And thanks for your support. There's a new threat to our gun rights in town. At least that's what the antis are telling us. Weird gives them a good look and shares his opinion in This Week in Anti-Gun Nuttery. So hey, Weird, what do you got for me this week?
So in my travels in the anti-gun spheres, I've been hearing a lot about the Firearms Accountability Council Task Force. They're allegedly the new biggest threat to our gun rights. Except that's all I've heard about them. At least until this NPR interview came out, interviewing lawyer Michael Scheisel.
There's a new coalition working against gun violence, a group of high-powered corporate law firms. After the Orlando nightclub shooting, a number of prominent attorneys banded together to collaborate at no cost with gun control advocates. Their goal is to attack gun issues through the courts and through state regulation.
So mostly it sounds like what the anti-gun side's been doing all my life, but different. Also, good choice on doing the work pro bono, because most of the anti-gun groups out there are dead broke, and Michael Bloomberg likely has enough lawyers on his personal staff. And since when did corporate lawyers become the good guys to the liberal media?
What they really need is our collective talent and our collective manpower. Everybody knows how well-financed and aggressive the gun lobby is, and I think it's going to require the brute force of the major law firms in this country.
Another quote that grossly shows why the anti-gun side is losing. So I can't lie and say the NRA doesn't have huge heaps of money to spend on advancing our gun rights. But he's being deceptive here by talking about the total budget of the NRA, which is a 501c3 nonprofit. The NRA itself is by law not allowed to make electioneering statements. Those actions are the sole job of their Political Action Committee, the NRA Institute for Legislative Action, or the NRA-ILA, which none of your NRA dues go to fund. But like any good flack, he avoids directly mentioning the NRA. Instead, he says, gun lobby, as if they are lobbying on behalf of guns instead of lobbying on behalf of gun owners. Well, the gun lobby also includes groups like the Second Amendment Foundation, Gun Owners of America, Pink Pistols, National Shooting Sports Foundation, and the countless state groups that are really quite small and need to be very smart with their money. Further, the NRA, despite what the anti-gun side says, represents all gun owners. So you'll see them taking action in every state every year, not picking and choosing strategic battles like the anti-gun side does. And when Michael Bloomberg decides to challenge them, he outspends the NRA-ILA in orders of magnitude. He outspends them, and he often loses. Also, the argument of collective talent is pretty foolish. Whatever anti-group is taking advantage of this coalition will be dealing with however many staffers each law firm is willing to give to a pro bono case. Meanwhile, groups like the NRA are true grassroots, and you have literally millions of people willing to lend their talents to a cause, free of charge. Kind of like the staff here at the Gunblog Variety Cast. So while this may bring a lot of new faces to groups that have almost no membership or participants, it's a drop in the bucket compared to the organic participation grassroots groups on the pro-Second Amendment side have been enjoying for decades.
there's a law called the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act, which effectively immunizes sellers of firearms from liability, except in a few cases.
Those few cases are any form of negligence that results in unsafe or faulty product, or any criminal acts. So really, everything. What the anti-gun side wants to conceal is that they are focusing on suits against manufacturers and retailers of guns and ammunition for criminal misuse of a product that is expressly forbidden by the manufacturer. This is like suing Ford and Budweiser because somebody got loaded on Bud Light, got in his F-150 and ran a family in a Ford Focus off the road. This is the suing of makers of insecticide when a crazy person mixes a jug of the stuff into their child's Easy Mac.
There's no other law at all that shields consumer products from safety regulation. And here we're talking about a product that can kill.
Again, a lie. This doesn't shield anybody from safety regulations. And the number of expensive safety recalls done by big-name gun makers should prove that to you, especially given that many of the guns being recalled had never had a documented injury or even a documented catastrophic failure. Remember my analogy about the insecticide? There's a product that's designed to kill. It requires certain safety regulations so that it isn't excessively dangerous to be around or improperly packaged, and it's required to be set with instructions on the safe use of it, but it still needs to kill. Otherwise, why buy the stuff? Gun owners occasionally shy away from the lethality of firearms. We get caught up on how a .22 target pistol isn't designed to kill, or other minutiae, when we should just be confronting it. Yes, the 1911 I'm carrying was designed as a lethal weapon. The reason why I'm carrying it is so I can use lethal force to protect my life and the lives of innocent people around me. There's no country in the world who argues that an innocent person cannot use lethal force to protect their lives or the lives of others. The only argument being made is that they don't like how effective firearms are for this purpose. These other countries want to limit their people to less effective weapons. And I say that's barbaric. Here's the best part. When he's questioned on his opposition to the PLCAA, he shies away from talking about suing gun makers and instead says this.
Yeah, it immunizes sellers. So, for example, there are state laws that literally immunize a gun seller of any liability, even if that gun seller knows he's selling a gun to a criminal.
State laws? So your opposition to a federal law is explained by citation of a state law? Also convenient that he doesn't mention which states. Not that it would matter, as gun sellers in this country need a federal license, and it's against federal law to sell to criminals. And federal law applies to all the states and U.S. territories, no matter what their local laws say.
There's another law, for example, that prevents the public from accessing data, gun data, that should be available under the Freedom of Information Act.
He's talking about the Tiahrt Amendment, which bans ATF trace data from being shared with anybody who isn't law enforcement. There's a reason for this. Like the PLCAA, which was enacted because the anti-gun groups were filing frivolous lawsuits against gun companies because of the acts of criminals, this amendment was filed because anti-gun groups were attempting to publish personal data against innocent people and companies to threaten and intimidate them. This behavior continues today at the state level, where anti-gun newspapers and groups have published the names and addresses of carry permit holders. And in some instances, criminals have used these lists to target homes for burglary so they can steal guns. This has led to similar prohibitions at the state level. Now moving on to his next issue.
As you know, some states now have very broad legal rights to carry guns on private property, such as bars and restaurants and schools. Mm-hmm. And what those laws do is they place the onus on the property owner to tell people either you can't come in with your gun or since you have a gun, I'm going to eject you from my premises.
This is, again, complete crap. This is how all laws work. If something is legal, then it's legal to do. I can legally walk around with no shoes. But the moment I walk into a business that requires shirt and shoes, they have the duty to enforce that policy. If carry is legal, it's legal. If somebody wants to have special rules for their property, it is up to them, not the state. Amusingly, what he's suggesting is government-backed bans on carry, meaning if a business owner actually wanted patrons to carry on premises, as many businesses recently have done, they would be the powerless ones. Funny how they're all for rights of the property owner until it doesn't suit their agenda.
The whole concept of private property is that you should be able to enjoy your property and use your property however you want. without the fear, frankly, of someone bringing a gun and putting that premises at risk.
What he's really proposing here is demanding that carry be illegal everywhere, except where it's explicitly allowed by the property owner. Of course he wants that because he's anti-gun. Except where have the winds of change been blowing? We now have 50 states that allow concealed carry, 10 states don't require a permit to carry at all, and countless other crappy gun laws have been rolled back or relaxed with only a handful of minor victories on the anti-gun board. So he's on the side that's getting its ass kicked up and down the field, but he wants to inconvenience the winning side from his position of strength? Also, I love that fear of putting the premises at risk, because concealed carriers cause so many problems, and violent criminals respect gun-free zone signs.
The NRA has now stated that one of its priorities is to push a nationwide concealed carry reciprocity federal law. It would allow gun owners licensed to carry in one state to be able to carry in any other state. And if the NRA were to be successful in passing federal legislation on this reciprocity, that means you could go get your gun in some state that has an easy threshold to get the gun and then conceal it, walk around Times Square here in New York carrying that gun. That's a frightening thought.
So let's give him the benefit of the doubt that what he meant was gun permits, not guns. I mean, you'd have to be a total moron of a lawyer specializing in gun banning to believe that you could buy a handgun anywhere other than the state you live, right? And he hasn't given us any reason in this segment to believe that he's a total moron, right? As it stands now, to carry in every state, you'd need your state permit and several other non-resident permits. And no matter what combination you chose, there would still be several states you simply couldn't ever be able to legally carry in. How much sense does that make? Further, like traffic laws, carry laws don't differ that much at all from state to state. Even training and safety protocols aren't very different. The big difference is anti-gun states will often outright refuse to give you a permit unless you are politically connected or can give the proper bribes. Is he afraid that if his beloved New York stopped with the bribes and corruption, it would suddenly get the violent crime problem of neighboring Vermont? Oh yeah, Vermont doesn't have a violent crime problem. Why is New York City any different than the entire state of North Carolina or Indiana who honor any out-of-state carry permit? Or the 10 states that don't require permits for people to carry? I'll tell you why. You can hear it in his voice. You can hear the condescension, can't you? You're not just imagining that. It's really there. The real reason why you can't carry in Times Square is a dirty little secret he doesn't want to be discussed. He hates you. You're one of those dirty redneck hicks who carry guns. Oh my God! Keep those booger-eating rednecks away from us! He's really talking to the people like himself. The people who want to live in the bubble.
What if there was a place where the unthinkable didn't happen and life could continue for progressive Americans just as before?
Now there is.
Welcome to The Bubble.
Coming in January 2017, The Bubble is a planned community of like-minded freethinkers and no one else.
In the world outside the bubble, people carry firearms against reasonably apprehended danger. But in the bubble, only angry monsters carry guns. He doesn't want reality to intrude on his fantasy world where nothing bad ever happens. This is the world where rather than teach women to fend off sexual predators, you could simply educate men not to rape. This is a world where gun violence isn't a bogus data set, but a real thing. And where guns are banned, violence itself is banned. And of course, by banning guns, there wouldn't be anybody violating that ban. The same way banning drugs means that no one sells them, right? If you make guns as illegal as murder, nobody will be murdered with guns.
All right, Weird. It was good to talk with you. I'll see you again next week.
See you next week, Sean.
In addition to appearing here, Weird is a regular host on The Squirrel Report and blogs at weirdworld.com. That's weerdworld.com.
Plug of the week. Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries. So Aaron, I sent this off to you and said, hey, you know, try this out. Tell me what you think. So, did you watch the show?
I watched the first episode, yes.
Guys, and a lot of you were guys, sometimes you got to sit down to a TV show or a movie with the wife or the girlfriend, and they want to see something that, well, maybe you're not really interested in. Now, I have an advantage in that pretty much everybody knows I'm a sucker for costume dramas. If they're going to play dress up and be from a different era, I'm going to want to watch it. But a lot of you just not interested in that. And there's a whole lot of lack of gun content in some of these movies because it's all about relationships and stuff like that. So I thought, you know what? I know a show that can probably satisfy both of you, both the men and the women. It's got the costume drama going on. It's got some romance. It's got action. It's got adventure. There's a gun, sometimes a couple of guns. Aaron, how would you describe that gun?
It is a pearl-handled, gold-plated 38. It is blinged out.
And she runs around with her finger on the trigger, which I am informed is period for the 1920s. That's what people did.
Oh, okay. See, I was going to complain about that, but hey, all right, if it's period accurate, I'll allow it.
So it's actually a fairly modern invention to keep your finger off the trigger. Basically, it's the story of this woman who is rich and has a title and lives in Australia, and she solves mysteries. She kind of backs into it in the first episode. She didn't, you know, start out solving mysteries, but she thought, this is fun. And so the rest of the series, there's like two seasons. I think there's 13 episodes per season. The rest of the series, she runs about solving mysteries and annoying the local constabulary. It's pretty funny, the reactions with each other.
It reminds me a lot of Agatha Christie's Hercule Poirot. I mean, people are going to say Miss Marples. I haven't read or watched any Miss Marples. But Poirot was a stuffy Belgian in London solving crimes, sometimes to the consternation of the police. And this is a bit like that, only in this case, she's a British aristocrat in Australia. I think in Melbourne, actually. No, I'm sorry.
Yep.
Melbourne. I was told that's how you pronounce that. But a British aristocrat in Melbourne solving murders to the dismay of the local police.
As a woman, Aaron, what would you say about the costume choices, the clothing? Is there something there for people to see if they're interested in that?
Well, I thought the various costumes that the star wore were quite lovely.
Yeah, and the guys are going to like it too, because she looks pretty good in them.
Yeah, she does. And she's not afraid to show some skin. I mean, there's no nudity, but she is not a prude by any means.
No, no. So, yeah, if you know, women who are unmarried having relations with men to whom they are not engaged even is going to be something that's going to bother you, this might not be the show for you. But if you want something a little bit on the racy side without any overt nudity or anything like that, some guns, some action, some adventure, and something for the ladies in your life that they might want to see that's not just another shoot 'em up, I think this might be the show for you. Give it a try. Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries. It's on Netflix streaming.
My earrings. That man was far too charming. What's the hurry? My driver's on his way.
I'll explain later. Good night, Aunt Prudence.
At this hour, it's not safe. Why do you think you can just run off on your own?
Because I'm carrying a gun.
Finally!
Well, that's our show for the week. Remember that the Gunblog Variety Cast is a member of the Self-Defense Radio Network.
Find the show notes at gunblogvarietycast.com/episode126.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Gunblog Variety Cast. Music courtesy of Rob Allen at blog.roballen.com. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and Google Play Music. This podcast is made possible by the Firearms Policy Coalition and by contributions from listeners like you. This is a URS production.